And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, we have the Chief Executive Officer of the YWCA Delaware, Stephanie Statz. And Stephanie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sue Ryan with the Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She said, you know, you've got to have Stephanie in here because they do such good work with us, and you're going to tell us all about it.
I am, yeah, and I really enjoyed our first conversation because the connecting point was through our work in the domestic violence and sexual violence space. But we do offer a lot more. The domestic violence, sexual violence work really is one of our lead programs. We work very closely with the Coalition Against Domestic Violence and with other service providers. But our mission is to eliminate racism and empower women. And we do that by offering a holistic grouping of programs to really address all the different dimensions of women's lives. And in addition to that, we have a strong advocacy arm to advance racial justice and social justice.
When you think about the history of the YWCA, it was always about the women. You want to give us the history?
YWCA was founded in the United States in 1858 in New York. And interestingly enough, it was founded as its own organization because the YMCA did not want to provide services for women at that time. And there was a rather scrappy group of women up in New York who recognized that there was great need for housing for single women. And the YMCA, who, by the way, are great friends locally, this was a long time ago when things were different, since the YMCA declined to partner with the women to provide the housing for young women, the ladies decided to start their own organization. And it's the YWCA. It started by offering housing for single women in New York. It has grown over time into a national movement. The YWCA Delaware was founded in 1895 in Wilmington, which makes this year our 125th anniversary.
Single women have always faced issues that men do not face, discrimination in work, and obviously housing. That was the whole purpose of this. And it's just part of the condition of being female in the society.
Right, absolutely. And it's interesting, I think, too, tease out that services are so often provided for single women. At the time that YW Delaware was founded, the issue was providing enrichment opportunities and peer opportunities for young women because there were so few options for them to expand their thinking, to interact with one another, frankly, to feel and be empowered by one another's existence, if you will. And so we started off in Delaware with housing, but also with, you know, everything from sewing classes to homekeeping and kind of those traditional roles that women held at the time. But I think what's interesting is that over time in Delaware, we have kept up with the needs of women as they've changed. So, you know, initially, a lot of it was kind of centered around home responsibility and the reality that women didn't have a lot of choices about what to concentrate their life and energy on. It was motherhood, it was being a wife. And over time, as women then were able to begin to enter the workforce, as they started to have more choices about their life path, they needed different types of support. And YWCA Delaware was there to help them with that support, again, as they entered the workforce, helping them to assimilate when they needed to assimilate, helping them to articulate their needs when those needed to be articulated as well, and also things like childcare. I mean, YWCA in Delaware was one of the first to provide quality childcare to women who were working at a time when that just really wasn't available. You would have a friend or a relative watch your children while you went to work, but there are plenty of women who don't have that option of friend or family. And so YWCA was really at the forefront of helping women get the support that they needed to achieve not only economic stability, but their economic potential. So that's just one example of how we have helped women as they've advanced
economic, educational, and housing are the things that would always keep a woman down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they still do. I mean, the work is not done. And I think that's part of what is so critical about YWCA's work as well. I mean, we offer program support in each of those areas, and housing in the interest of family stability and making sure women and their children are safe and secure. So we have housing. We offer programs in health and safety that concentrates a lot on addressing gender-based violence. So our domestic violence work, our sexual violence work. And then in the economic empowerment space, kind of going back to when women entered the workforce, now they're earning an income. Well, how do you manage that? We offer still financial coaching. We have a first-time homebuyers program. We have job readiness and self-employment programs. We offer programs for youth. But underlying all of that work is the acknowledgement of the reality that there are biases against women. There are biases against different races and ethnicities, and they create additional barriers to an individual reaching their full social and economic potential.
If you're doing this holistic approach and you're trying to support women and families, you need to know where their issues lie, what their real problems are, and you are part of a national organization. You just finished a big research project.
We did. YWCA USA recently released a national survey, and what that survey showed us was what the preeminent concerns of women are right now. And not surprisingly, they focused in three or four different areas: economic security, health, safety, caregiving responsibilities was a big one. And around the same time that the YW National Office was conducting their survey in Delaware, we were doing our own strategic planning, and that included local surveying. And some of what we found as issues of concern were family homelessness. I mean, women are truly concerned about the housing stability of their families. The number one cause of, for single women in particular, the number one cause of homelessness is domestic violence. Sexual violence, mm-hmm. we discovered or had really reaffirmed the prevalence, the fear, and also the economic impact. I mean, it's almost $200,000 over the lifetime of a survivor that it cost her literally over the course of her lifetime if she doesn't have appropriate interventions and support to heal and move forward. And $200,000 is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for a gender that traditionally makes less anyway and isn't going to have the earning power to begin with.
Exactly, exactly. And that's part of why on the programmatic side, we also, one, found in our survey that economic insecurity continues to be a concern. For us, it helped affirm that we are in the right programmatic space by continuing to offer and enhance our economic empowerment programs, in particular to help individuals increase their household income through self-employment or enhancing their career readiness.
Who comes through your doors and how do they discover you?
Oftentimes they discover us by word of mouth. Also social media. I always ask folks to follow us on our social media. We're on the big three, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Also, our website is always up, ywcade.org. And you can get most of your information off the website. The navigation will help you get to the program that you most want to connect with. And we also hope at the same time it exposes you to the breadth of the work that we do. We have found consistently that the women that we work with have multiple issues that they don't always realize that they have when they come through our doors. So, for example, we'll have someone that will come to us because, actually, this happened not that long ago. We had a young woman who came to us because she wanted to buy a home. First-time home buyer. She had very little credit. She did not have a lot of experience with household budgeting. She had limited job skills. And that's okay, because we work with everybody that comes through the door. And if you think you're going to be ready to buy a house in a month, and we find out it's probably going to be more like a year, maybe a couple years, no problem. That's the specialness of our counseling staff to help folks stay motivated. But this particular client, what was interesting was that as she developed a relationship with her own homeownership counselor, she disclosed to the counselor that the whole reason that she was looking to purchase a home is because she was in an abusive relationship and she was trying to get out of the abusive relationship. And she understood that part of being able to be on her own was to have safe, stable, independent housing that she could support on her own. And so instead of this being, you know, a client-counselor relationship that's just focused on, let's talk about how you can improve your credit. Let's talk about budgeting so you can have enough in your, you know, bank account to put a down payment on the house. Let's talk about the different ways we can qualify you for home buyer assistance. The relationship went beyond that, and it went into, let's talk about safety planning. Let's talk about how and when to help you break away from the situation you're in now and move forward to independence. And we were able to seamlessly connect her with our domestic violence counselors. And that's something that's really unique about YWCA. It's all right there. It's very low barrier. And that's why we offer the breadth of programs that we do, because we know through our 125 years in existence in Delaware that it's very rare that what connects a person to us is the only thing going on in their life that is keeping them from reaching their full economic and social potential. We recognize from our academic pursuits, if you will, from surveys that we do, from research that we do to inform how we design our programs. So there's the academic input that tells us that very rarely, if ever, does an individual just have one thing going on in a silo, that if that one thing is addressed, everything will be all better for them. The research shows us, in addition to that, our actual practice shows us that what most often is the case is that women have multiple things going on in their lives. There's multiple dimensions to their lives. And if something is broken or something is not going well in one dimension, it's not uncommon that that's either caused by something going on in another dimension in her life, or it's certainly influencing. So it's almost like a codependent relationship. Mm-hmm. And you have to break that dependency in part by addressing everything. And we have found that our clients are more successful when they can stay with us to have services and support in those different dimensions. So it's housing, economic, their health and safety. They do better when they can stay with us to have those needs addressed, rather than us saying, okay, well, we can help you with your housing, but you have to go over here for your therapy. You have to go over here for your you have to take your kids over here for something else. It's hard enough and brave to be able to walk into the door of somewhere and say, I need help, to add additional burden to mm-hmm. them to have to leave and go build a relationship with somebody else and get their needs addressed there. We just don't want to do that. We're a nurturing place.
You open that door to help, and there are no closed rooms after that.
Correct. Well said. Thank you.
Eventually, I get around to a good point.
I'll write that down for myself.
Eventually.
Thank you.
And, of course, all of this is found at ywcade.org. And today we are talking to its Chief Executive Officer, Stephanie Statz. Let's turn to your advocacy work here. Women have gender biases against them, but then throw in ethnicity and race, and you've got just the perfect storm for lack of opportunity.
Absolutely. And we believe at YWCA that racism and sexism are the root cause for disparities that we see, and really every indicator of quality of life. So when you look at educational outcomes, when you look at economic opportunity, earning potential, when you look at health outcomes, I mean, you see where women, where non-dominant race, non-dominant ethnicities, you see where their rates of positive outcomes are lower. And the research clearly supports that. And so what that tells us is there's something else going on besides, you know, access to a financial coaching program, you know, so you can learn how to repair your credit. And because repairing your credit is what's keeping you from getting a better paying job. We know that the reality that the number one cause of homelessness for single moms is domestic violence. There's something else going on that is unique to women, that is unique to minorities, that especially when you put those two things together, if you have a, you know, an African-American female, I mean, you've got even more oppressions, if you will, to be able to overcome, to be able to have access to opportunity and the ability or the opportunity to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. It's just harder. And the research supports that. It's just harder. So, you know, to your point, at YWCA, that's what, you know, we're trying to do and have done successfully for many years. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. We're far from a utopian society where everything is there's equity for all. But we do have our actual programs, our Home Life Management Center, our Sexual Assault Response Center, our Economic Empowerment Programs, our Youth Development Programs. But underlying all that, or kind of a foundational piece of all that, is our racial and social justice work. And for us, that's really the vehicle through which we are working very hard to address some of the systemic barriers that are there that keep women and their families from advancing and achieving their full potential.
But then the barrier is put up, though, by society, the hiring, the education system, and going back generations before you in housing, et cetera. You might erase it from your programming, but how do you get the participants on the other side to bend and open their eyes?
Right. It's hard work. And honestly, you know, one of the main questions that I get from people when they're first hearing about YWCA, they say, your mission's eliminating racism and empowering women. And, you know, we get the empowering women, but there's no way you're going to eliminate racism. And, you know, I say, well, that shouldn't keep us from trying. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, I mean, we've got multiple generations of systemic racism, systemic sexism. So we are not alone going to be able to topple those systems. But here's what we can do, and here's what we do now, is we make sure that we offer opportunities, one, for individuals to learn and explore their own biases and to learn and explore the experiences of people who are different from them. Or said another way, we provide opportunities for people to develop their cultural competency. We have found that in providing opportunities, and we do this specifically through dialogue to action groups, when we put together small groups of people with diverse backgrounds and we facilitate conversations about race with them, that it starts off very uncomfortable because these are hard conversations to have, difficult conversations to have. But after folks get over that initial hump, it becomes a very cathartic experience and a true experience for personal growth. So that's the first thing that we're trying to do, is we're trying to give individuals the opportunity to explore their own thinking, the origin of that thinking, which is so much influenced by environment. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once an individual has started on that journey of having their own awareness raised, understanding how their inherent bias affects how they behave and make decisions about other people, that you have to change the heart and mind first. And then through that, we inspire people to action. So I said Dialogue to Action is the name of our groups that we convene twice a year in the spring and the fall. And so that action piece is really important. That happens at the end. So the dialogue happens over about a 10-hour period over 5 weeks. The group will kind of determine, you know, what schedule works best for them. But it's about a 10-hour process. And at the end, what happens is now people are inspired to do something. They have had an awakening of some sort, and everybody's on their own personal journey. But there has been an awakening, and now there's a desire to do something. And so what we do is we incubate that desire, if you will. And so, you know, we encourage idea generation. We don't give people ideas, but we'll kind of tease it out of a group. And then that group will gel around action with that idea. We'll incubate a little bit, help them get organized, and send them on their way.
So you're hoping that awareness will lead to action.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll give you a recent example. We had a dialogue to action group that at the conclusion of their dialogue, they talked a lot about access to mainstream financial services and how depressed communities don't have that access. And as a result, there's visits to check cashing places, there's, you know, cashing of checks in retail stores and liquor stores. And that's all a much more expensive way, right, to handle cash. In addition, you know, we live in a consumer society. Credit's really important. Well, when you're, you know, cashing checks and carrying around, when you don't have a bank account, that inhibits your ability to build credit, which inhibits your access to building wealth over time, et cetera, et cetera. So this dialogue group, their action is they said, look, when we look at the Route 9 corridor, here's what I don't see. I don't see any mainstream banking institution. I see check cashers. I see signs and windows of stores that say, we'll cash your check for a fee. I don't see a bank anywhere. I don't see an ATM. And so amazingly, they were able to, over time, they built a partnership with a credit union, and they are in the process of bringing a credit union to that Route 9 corridor for the first time ever.
I really didn't know how were you going to accomplish your goal, and yet you're able to do this. Now, you have another thing, though. What's on the menu?
So on the menu is a series that we just recently launched, and on the menu is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so to that end, we have four different sessions that we are making available to organizations, to businesses, to groups, to anyone that's looking to understand and increase their cultural competency, their understanding and ability to be inclusive within their own organizations, to understand unconscious bias, which is huge, and also to understand microaggressions and how we all have biases, how we all
reflect them.
So this four-part series can be done, you know, about 60 minutes each, and it can go as a series or they can go standalone. But we developed this in response to request. So we would go out and kind of do a one-off when we would have an organization or a group request it, and we found that we were getting requests for the same type of information. So we put together a series.
And for a business to take advantage, or any organization, it means that they're then opening the door to having a bigger workforce and a larger client base.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a win.
it's a total win because, you know, we certainly believe at YWCA that diversity, equity, and inclusion are the right thing to do, right, from a value-based standpoint. But, you know, the business case for it is pretty strong. So, you know, for a for-profit business, again, research shows, you know, you have an inclusive corporate culture, you will ultimately increase your profits. If you are a nonprofit organization where, you know, your motive is to create or increased social good, that too will be enhanced by having a more inclusive organizational culture. So it's really a win-win.
You're out in the public. We can reach out to you and you'll talk about sexual violence and rape. And let's use that word, take the stigma off it. And you'll talk about getting teens aware of these issues as well. How do we interact with you as just a general public?
Well, there's lots of ways to engage with us. I mean, certainly as an access point, you know, we have the social media accounts and our general number and our website and so forth. But one of the things that we like to make sure that we're available for is to really help raise awareness of the issues that we're serving to address, both through our programmatic work, but also our advocacy work. And so to that end, we have, I guess, kind of a de facto speakers bureau, if you will. We'll come out for Women's History Month, which is, you know, right around the corner. We also have Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April. And, you know, we try to encourage folks to invite us in. You had mentioned a few minutes ago about taking the stigma off the word rape. I've talked to many people about, you know, my own learning. I'll say as an aside, this will be our fifth year with our Sexual Assault Response Center. So we're celebrating another anniversary with SARC. But I very naively, when, you know, SARC was brought into YWCA, I very naively thought, oh my gosh, well, this issue affects so many people. I'm going to go talk to people. I'm going to say we have a rape crisis center, and they're going to say that's wonderful, and they're going to want to talk and learn. And I quickly found out that that wasn't the case, only because people were so uncomfortable with the word rape that as soon as that came out of my mouth, it was like a wall.
They shut down.
They shut down. And so what we try to do is we try to destigmatize that word. One, because if we don't acknowledge that rape exists, if we don't acknowledge the prevalence of it, and the violence of it, we are never going to take away the taboo of discussing it and ultimately addressing it in a more powerful way than we have in years past.
We've been talking about women with low incomes, but if you're in a bad relationship, you might have the fanciest house on the block, but once you leave, you're not secure.
Yeah, that's actually one of the misconceptions about the work that we do, that we only work with women who are low income. And that's not the case. We work with all incomes, especially in our health and safety work. To your point, I mean, there's not, health and safety does not discriminate by, especially with domestic violence and sexual violence. We are available to anybody that needs our services. Our economic empowerment work is the same. We work with a lot of people in kind of the early phases of working towards economic stability. But we also work with a lot of women who are just going through life changes. That could be a divorce. It could be widowhood. It could be someone who has not worked outside the home and doesn't have that history. So, you know, we're really there and do our best to be there for women at every phase of their life. And the other misconception is that we don't work with men, and that's not true. Each one of our programs also works with men. We do have our histories serving women, and we are true to that history, but we do not exclude men.
You're doing a party in May, right? It's an anniversary event.
Yes.
And I know you are looking for volunteers. You have to, because you do have the SARC hotline and you have centers. So you need volunteers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there really are a lot of ways to get engaged. And so, but we have volunteer opportunities in each one of our programs. So in the racial justice space, we're always looking for discussion facilitators. We're looking for folks to participate in our Stand Against Racism event, which is at the end of April. We will have a big forum at the end of that month, and are looking for volunteers to serve in a variety of capacities to help advance our racial justice work. For SARC, we are always looking for helpline specialists. It's called specialists for a reason. There is intense training that happens before someone can work the hotline. But we are always looking for hotline workers. We also are always looking for, we call them SARAs, our sexual assault response advocates, and folks to help with our resource center. Special events. We do have a wonderful anniversary celebration coming up in May, on May 14th, and that will celebrate our 125th anniversary. One of the fun projects, I think, leading up to that is being 125 years old. We have boxes and boxes archived, but not cataloged. So we have all this really cool ephemera over the past 125 years of different events, different correspondents. But we have a lot of materials that, you know, we're working to catalog, and we will display some of them at our anniversary celebration in May. So we're looking for volunteers for that project as well.
So no matter what your skill level is, there's something to do there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Give us a call. Go on the website. We keep our volunteer opportunities up to date. Take a look. See what piques your interest. And then reach out to us and let us know what piques your interest, because there really are, you know, a range of opportunities for all different skills and interest levels.
Now, you know what? We are totally out of time. So here is where I have to say that if you'd like more information about absolutely everything we have talked about, YWCADE.org. They do have the SARC hotline, and that's the Sexual Assault Response Center, and that's 800-773-8570. But you can find that on their website as well. Information about all of their programming and their advocacy work, YWCADE.org. And my thanks go to its Chief Executive Officer today, Stephanie Statz. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.